Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, why did soldiers on the front lines of one of the deadliest wars lay down their arms and play soccer with the very men they were supposed to shoot? We'll revisit the Christmas Truce of 1914. But first, can worker-owned cooperatives transform workers' lives and livelihoods? With us is Jessica Gordon-Nembhart. Jessica Gordon-Nembhart is a professor of community justice and social economic development at the Department of Africana Studies at John Jay College of the City University of New York. She's director of the McNair Post-Baccalaureate Achievement Program. Her latest book is Collective Courage, A History of African-American Cooperative Economic Thought and Practice. Welcome to the Scholar's Circle, Jessica Gordon-Nembhart. It's great to have you here with us.
Thank you very much.
Very excited about your work, your study of cooperatives, cooperative economies, and history within the United States in particular. I thought we should start with somebody that you cited, which was W.E.B. Du Bois' theory. Could you give us an idea of what that theory is exactly?
I'm actually still struggling with how best to talk about it. But basically, Du Bois argued that because African Americans were more than just marginalized, but were sort of the lowest of the low on the economic totem pole, were pretty much left out of mainstream economics, were discriminated against in all the markets, we needed to do something a little different. And that is to kind of turn inward a little bit, use what he called voluntary segregation, or what most of us talk about as solidarity economics, or even black nationalism, in terms of looking into the group itself and creating a group economy based on cooperative economics that would really make sure to deliver all the goods and services and deliver the kind of economy that would help make the whole black community prosperous and that would get us out of the oppressive system that we were in. He's got lots of great quotes, but one is about how we can use intelligent economic cooperation to enter the new city as men and women and not mules, meaning, and the new city for him was, this is at the turn of the century, he's talking about how industrialization is really going to take off and new forms of industrialization are going to be the way to prosperity, and that African Americans can use cooperative ownership and cooperative democratic forms of economics to actually propel us in a position to be unequal, if not to exceed what the mainstream U.S. capitalist economy is doing and stop being the mules of the economy and the mules of the society and actually be the intellectual economic leaders. So it's kind of very exciting. He has another quote about being at the forefront of industrial development and even another quote about how co-ops are going to help us to insulate ourselves and isolate and insulate ourselves and form a strong economic phalanx of prosperity and economic stability so that we can't be harmed by these other forces. So it's an interesting notion about how a group of people with a common interest, in this case class and race, can come together and use democratic cooperative economics to both our economic needs, but also to help propel us into a new and better economic system that would really help everybody.
One of the things that I find most compelling about cooperative economics is the idea of democratic workplace and the idea that it's participatory, where people actually get to make decisions together, one person, one vote, and then they share in the proceeds of it so that it's more egalitarian than a standard corporate model.
Absolutely.
So can you give us a little bit of background in terms of how these have actually worked? I'm mostly interested in the worker-owned co-ops, but I know you've studied many different forms of cooperatives. Can you kind of give us a thumbnail sketch of how these, in a practical way, work?
Even though I've been studying all different kinds of cooperative ownership, I've focused on worker co-ops whenever I could because I really think that they're one of our most important structures and one of the best ways, as you say, to democratize capital and to really have widespread economic participation and ownership and real democracy in our economic relations. So I have studied particularly late 20th century and 21st century worker-owned co-ops often among people of color, but not always among people of color. And I even have done some work specifically about women of color, particularly black women, in worker co-ops. And what we're finding is that worker co-ops, especially the ones that have actually been part of social mission and a social enterprise model, which would be ones like Cooperative Home Care Associates in the South Bronx of New York City, or Mandela Food Co-op in, I think it's Western Oakland in California, or some of the sewing co-ops that have been in the South. There were two in North Carolina. There's one right now, I think that's also in North Carolina, also Opportunity Threads. There's some catering co-op, and child care co-ops. So there's Child Space in Philadelphia and a few other child care co-ops and babysitting co-ops. What we're finding with these worker co-ops is that they're able to take often very low-wage jobs that we wouldn't consider good. Like when we talk about a good job, right, we mean it pretty much has a living wage. You have benefits like vacation time, sick leave, sometimes retirement benefits. You also have the ability to move up in the job, so job ladder success. So these worker co-ops have been able to take industries and businesses that normally don't do that, like home care normally doesn't even give its employees full-time work because, you know, often they're just piecing together. You might be working for an elderly couple 5 hours a day, 3 or 4 times a week, but that's not really full-time work. It doesn't usually pay a living wage. It has no benefits, etc. So Cooperative Home Care Associates, for example, has taken that work and done two things at the same time. The first thing is they've raised the quality of the job, but partly they've done that by raising the quality of the work. So they also have an arm that does specified training so that all of their worker owners go through the same high-quality training so they can make sure that they're giving the kind of quality work that deserves the kind of quality pay and benefits and things that they want. They're also able to piece together full-time work for women, even if it ends up that they have to work in two different people's homes. But they pull together the work so that women have full-time jobs. They also pay living wages. The members get retirement funds. They are able to give back dividends because they're a profitable business. So, and most worker co-ops are for profit, so that they actually have profits or surplus at the end that can then be divided between going back into the business and being given back to the members as dividends. So some years the women have made 25% of their initial investment in the company back in 1 year, so that they have an investment, an asset, as well as a really good job, as well as high-level training, and then they also have ability to move up in the organization. They can move from the lowest level of home care to get higher credentials in nursing. They can move over into the training arm of the company. They can move up into the management part of the company. Sort of like the old days, they can sort of stay in the business almost forever or for a long period of time because they don't get stuck in the lowest wage job or that kind of thing. And the other thing that Chaka in particular was able to do was they actually lobbied the state and city governments to reallocate Medicare money to pay for home care, which was one of the ways to up the wages for the whole industry so that when they had their living wages, they were more competitive in the industry. And we see that with some of the other groups, though not quite as successfully. See the same thing in child care, right? Raising the quality of child care work because the women own their own company. They pay attention to high-quality training. They're paid a living wage. They work well with the parents. They own part of the company, so if there are profits and surplus, they can get that back as extra, you know, return on their investment. They develop leadership skills, and so they assert themselves more in their own families, in their own communities, even on the job. A lot of these worker-owned companies are also unionized, and the union really either or both helps them to provide some of the benefits like health benefits and things, and also helps them to remember that they're owners and workers. And so how do they pay attention to the issues as workers? The union helps them do that, and then the board meetings and other parts of the company help to remind them their owners and that they can make other kinds of decisions also. And so it's an interesting collaboration. As you sort of said, it's kind of the best of both worlds. I believe it's a way to both raise the dignity of work as well as build assets. And then I really think the leadership development and the other social skills and social capital that gets developed is almost just as important as the finance capital they're able to gain.
If we contrast and actually fit this into larger economic questions and larger economic structures, one of the things I've been thinking about is that we've seen the world move into this sort of neoliberal age where increasingly the labor is contracted out, wages have been forced down because there's
right.
a competition for them.
Unions have been busted.
And unions have been busted, right. And so there's been, on one side, this move towards this competitive environment versus the co-op. But I wonder, in the shape of a neoliberal economy, which seems to be nearly global at this stage, how do these fit in? Are they proliferating? Can they become entire communities of cooperatives that work together? Or are they eventually going to get drowned out by a neoliberal economy?
The first thing let me just put on the table is, while we're definitely seeing this deunionization and kind of a modifying of work and making work worse, but also having less people have even access to jobs. So that's one movement and theme that's happening in this neoliberal world. There also is a movement in the multinationals and a lot of the corporations that are actually democratizing their workplaces more because they're realizing that they're more productive. They can get higher rates of production out of employees who actually are given more responsibility, respect, and ability to work together. So there's a lot more of these quality circles and labor management boards and things. And a lot of the most profitable multinational companies actually practice a somewhat of workplace democracy. The problem is they don't go far enough, right? So it's a weird thing. In some ways, capitalism is still thriving because it has appropriated some of the best practices of having workers have a say and work together and that kind of thing. And yet at the same time, they're able to use that to oppress workers more, and especially in places like the U.S., reduce jobs and the quality of jobs. So it's a really weird or interesting, whichever way you want to look at it, tension. And I don't know exactly what we should do about that, except to say that I think in some ways I'm hopeful that even the neoliberal companies are in some ways moving more towards some other things. But the other thing that makes me hopeful, which is the second way I wanted to answer that, is to think about the move toward privatization and the ways that the co-op movement in Emilia-Romagna in Italy have handled that. And even though in the Emilia-Romagna region they've been privatizing and downsizing and things like that, the response, because they're from a very, I guess, liberal, progressive co-op region, has been to privatize toward cooperatives, right? In fact, worker co-ops, in fact, what we call social co-ops. And I'm very excited by that movement, and I do think that that kind of a movement can grow and should grow and will grow in the United States. So the social co-ops are worker-owned co-ops that provide social services in some way. So you could count teachers, but often it's counselors, psychologists, child care providers, drug rehabilitation workers, people in all those kinds of social services. And as the government started to privatize those services, instead of providing them through municipalities and government-owned agencies, the privatization, a lot of it happened as co-op development. They have laws now that actually encourage social service workers to join, create their own worker co-ops, and they can still tap into the public money in the sense of if you have somebody who's on disability, their public money can go to pay for you to service them as a disabled and to help work with them. So there's a growing group of small to medium-sized social cooperatives that are really doing a lot of the work that we originally thought the welfare state should do. And so, of course, no one's happy that the welfare state is not doing it, but at least if they're not doing it, having co-ops do it and worker co-ops do it seems to be a good compromise or a good solution. And it seems like these worker co-ops are growing. The other thing that's really exciting for the Italian model is that they also have another level of worker co-op, which is what they call Type B. And that's where the social service worker, as part of the therapy for the mentally challenged, for the disabled, for the recovering addicts, they actually help some of their clients to create worker co-ops as part of the therapy and part of the ways to help them. So recovering addicts and returning citizens might be doing landscaping or tutoring or other kinds of small businesses that they're also owning as worker co-ops. So we have a nice system there with a lot of interlocking different kinds of worker co-op addressing a lot of the issues in society. So that's the social co-op kind of notion. And it seems like in the U.S., we don't have those laws, but we are moving toward more and more worker co-ops in some of those areas. And the final way I would answer it is I also think that one of the ways we have to approach this growing neoliberalism is to actually bring industry and manufacturing back to the U.S. And again, one of the ways we can do that is through worker co-ops. Because we have seen, in fact, the United Steelworkers are working on this with the Mondragon, which is the other great worker co-op example in northern Spain, and they're trying to create more worker co-ops in industrial world, especially like with alternative energy, solar energy, recycling. I'm trying to think of what some of the other examples are. And so again, using the co-ops to solve sort of social problems, but also to help re-employ or employ people and to bring back those high-quality jobs, I think, are the major ways that we're able to fight this neoliberalism. And in some ways, we're under the radar. So I'm hoping that we can get a critical mass of these kinds of co-ops established in the U.S. before anyone decides that it's a problem and tries to attack it full force. But I may be too Pollyanna-ish on that one.
You mentioned in one of your articles about plans that had been put forward in Jackson, Mississippi by the mayor Lumumba to create an entire cooperative economy. Can you describe how he saw that there? And then can you connect it also to maybe what happened in Detroit? Mike, our engineer, and I were talking about Detroit before we got you on the line. Can you contrast what his vision was with what has happened there and then in Detroit?
When Mayor Lumumba got elected, one of his platforms was to really change the economy so that everybody could work, but also the economy would be doing things that would help the community and solve community problems. And also, I think the mayors before him had started to privatize a lot of things like the waste management and the recycling and that kind of thing. So one idea he had was that he could do what the Italians did instead of just having them go to private, for-profit, sole proprietor companies. These services could be given or earned by worker co-ops that would be doing the recycling, doing the waste management, that kind of thing. So he had this idea of sort of taking back a lot of those privatized businesses, taking them back for communities so that they'd be worker-owned companies. And then he also wanted to help promote more worker ownership in general around Jackson, both to solve the unemployment, also to solve the low pay issue, and to kind of create a better, a more sustainable and stable, prosperous economy for Jackson. I guess he has, is it three prongs? I'm not sure I have the right number, but anyway, probably three prongs. The first prong was actually education, so that 2014 Jackson Rising Conference was all about education. Its original plan was to educate about 5,000 Mississippians about what is a cooperative, how to start one, etc. So it was supposed to be a sort of massive training program that could then launch a whole citywide co-op incubation project and then to continue to do co-op education and co-op incubation so that, again, these kinds of businesses that I just talked about could be formed, and you would have people who understood how to do it. So the first prong was education. The second prong was just identifying the industries and sometimes even firms that could be transitioned into worker co-ops. So, again, looking at the companies that had just been privatized that used to be city-owned, looking at businesses where the owner was ready to retire and had no one to turn the business over to, so thinking about the succession plan and turning those over to their, and selling the business to the employees, that kind of thing. So that second prong was to figure out what businesses would be good to go into, either new businesses or these municipal service businesses or these succession businesses. And I guess the third piece was just his, you know, political platform, to have enough of a groundswell of people who were supporting him, so that you had people who wanted to do the training who were petitioning their city council members or aldermen, I can't remember what they're called in Jackson, and making sure that there was that public pressure, right, to keep doing this, that the rest of the city council saw that people really wanted this kind of economic change and these kind of economic things. So the real kickoff was supposed to be this Jackson Rising Conference, which still happened even though he was dead by the time they put it on. And then that Jackson Rising would launch the rest of this program. And then the hope was that there would be at least the recycling co-op, I guess, that would be sort of the first of many that would take off. So a lot of momentum was lost because Lumumba died. But the conference did happen. Now, it didn't have 5,000 people, but it had about 600 people, which I think we all can fairly say was the largest cooperative conference of predominantly African Americans, maybe since the Young Negroes Cooperative League's first conference in 1930 or something. So significant conference, even though it didn't live up to its original plan. And Cooperation Jackson is the name of the group of some of Lumumba's followers and supporters who then regrouped themselves outside of the city government and now are doing urban farming. They're still trying to do the recycling co-op. They have a building called the Lumumba Community Center where they are doing education and have a co-op cafe. And I think they have one other project underway. It's gone much slower than they expected, but they're still, you know, they're still trudging along and moving along. The connections with Detroit are the two cities probably have very similar issues. Detroit probably even worse than Jackson in terms of industries have basically left. Lots of people who actually were relatively skilled because they had worked in some skilled industries but now have no work at all. A lot of vacant properties. So Detroit, my understanding is, has a lot of informal urban farming going on and stuff. Lots of opportunity to kind of think about how to re-industrialize the city, particularly starting with the small worker co-ops and moving out from there. I went to Detroit once or twice to talk to some of the food security movements and some of the co-op development centers there, and they're trying to connect to the urban farming and use the local produce that's coming out of the urban farming and then do co-op restaurants or community-owned restaurants. I've seen some groups also trying to get back the industrial centers, so that these, what's it called, make-it centers, where young people and other people can share equipment to actually make things. One of my groups, the Solidarity Economy Network, the U.S. Solidarity Economy Network, is actually having a conference with our Canadian partners. We're doing a sort of North American Solidarity Economy Summit in Detroit in April, and we're trying to highlight the things that are happening in Detroit, but also talk about the issues of deindustrialization, racism, et cetera, and how the solidarity economy, which is sort of co-ops and broader non-exploitative economic relationships, how we can push those forward in a city like Detroit.
In terms of externalities is what they call them, where these massive corporations are generally forcing the cost of environmental cleanup or environmental damage or damage to the community or damage to human rights onto the rest of the world so that they don't have to pay, therefore take more profit. Have there been studies that show the contrast between that unsustainable behavior in that case with what cooperatives generally do?
Some of us are looking for research on that, and there's not a lot yet. There was one study in Canada which was a little bit discouraging because it said that co-ops aren't any more ecological than any other business. But a lot of us have been arguing that because co-ops are so local-based and owned by local community members who live and work in the same place, that just for that reason they're a little bit more ecologically minded, because they have to live in the same place that they work, and if their workplace is polluting it, they're not going to be happy with that. And also a lot of the newly emerging markets for co-ops are in sustainable energy and recycling and clean up things and stuff. So in some ways, the intuitiveness is that co-ops are much more about ecological sustainability and ecological transformation. We don't know yet because there aren't enough studies to really tell us what's going on, but we do know that those are a lot of the areas that co-ops are emerging in to address those issues and to do those industries. So I don't know exactly how to answer your question, except I think the promising growth is to see so many co-ops, particularly worker co-ops, going into solar energy and alternative energy, to be doing a variety of recycling things, to be doing waste management. There's a new really exciting worker co-op in Boston called Cero, C-E-R-O, that I think they're doing something in waste management and recycling and mostly working with low-income people of color in Boston. And they were able to buy trucks and things like that. There's, as I said, the waste management project in Jackson, Mississippi. There's a new co-op starting in Prince George's County, Maryland, which is right outside of Washington, D.C. They're trying to solve the water runoff problem, where, you know, toxic water is going into the drains and back into the water system and into the rivers and that kind of thing. And they're using a worker co-op model for that. Those are the two areas where we're seeing the largest growth in worker co-ops, at least in the U.S., in the social services and in the ecological recycling. So if that's true, then even if we can't prove that co-ops in general or the old-style co-ops are more ecological, we certainly know that the growth in the worker co-op movement, one of the areas, is that area. And it's very promising because we're solving, again, community problems at the same time that you're providing decent work and democratizing the economic structures and employment.
There seems to be from my reading, a growth in the number of cooperatives. Do you think that that is validated by real numbers when you do a larger look?
It's a little of both. What I would say is this. The co-op movement in general is actually constricting in some areas and growing in others. So there's definitely a constriction in some of the agricultural co-ops and some of the old co-ops, like the big granaries and things like that in Canada and the U.S. They've definitely been demutualizing. And even the credit unions, there's fewer in number, though there seem to be more members, even though there's fewer credit unions. But part of that is because the regulators have been forcing credit unions to close. So that's a whole other issue. But at the same time, certainly there's a market growth in worker co-ops and food co-ops. And I think because worker co-ops and food co-ops are innovative ways to solve immediate local economic problems. Also, we've been in pretty terrible economic times. You know, we had the greatest recession since the Great Depression, that kind of thing. So I think we're seeing that, at least on a more grassroots, local level, the issues about food security and issues about creating better jobs, at least, as I said, in the social co-ops and the ecology, seem to be really important. Worker co-ops are particularly growing among urban immigrant communities, often because they can't find other work, and so they're finding that working together solves a lot of things. We're seeing, as I said, industries that seem to be needed in the local community are being created by people who want to work together in co-ops, so those are the ecological ones. We're also seeing not just consumer food co-ops, but also food services, right? So the bakeries of the Arizmendi Group in the Bay Area are really I guess what, they're up to six now, catering co-ops, even low, small level ones, and then some co-op restaurants and things seem to be jumping up in New York City, Boston, some other areas. So I think we have to really start to disaggregate the co-op world when we've been talking about what's happening with co-ops, because it's very different when you look at some of the older, more established co-ops, and then when you look at these younger, new model, smaller, more grassroots co-ops. And the growth is really in these younger, smaller, grassroots, worker-owned co-ops, as I said, that are really looking to solve a variety of problems and are being either created by people themselves who are coming together to do the work, or by nonprofits and other community organizations that are really doing social entrepreneurship and social mission co-ops. That seems to be, I think, where the growth is. And I would say rightly so, because that's really where the needs are. So for me, it's exciting to see that co-ops are continuing to do what they've always done, identify needs and solve economic and social problems. And I see co-ops doing that in the U.S., so I'd like to see more, but at least they're doing it.
Jessica Gordon-Nembhard, thank you so much for being with us here on the Scholar Circle.
Thank you so much.
Jessica Gordon-Nembhard is a professor of community justice and social economic development at the Department of Africana Studies at John Jay College of the City University of New York. She's director of the McNair Post-Baccalaureate Achievement Program. Her latest book is Collective Courage, A History of African-American Cooperative Economic Thought and Practice. She's also been elected to the U.S. Cooperative Hall of Fame. When we come back, why did soldiers on the front lines of one of the deadliest wars lay down their arms and play soccer with the very men they were supposed to shoot? We'll revisit the Christmas truce of 1914. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. Welcome to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. World War I was one of the deadliest periods in human history, but it was also the time of one of the most profound, impromptu expressions of humanity. Tens of thousands of soldiers on the front lines laid down their arms, exchanged gifts, songs, and makeshift soccer balls in what became known as the Christmas Truce. How did the peace come about? And what do the historic events tell us about humanity? Stanley Weintraub joins us now. He's a professor emeritus at Pennsylvania State University, a historian and author. His more than 50 books include Silent Night, the story of the World War I Christmas Truce. Welcome, Stanley Weintraub.
Glad to be with you.
I thought perhaps we should start with a little bit of context of what was going on during World War I in 1914 before the Christmas truce.
We have to think that Christmas was not on the minds of soldiers on either side in mid-December 1914. The weather was cold, rain just above freezing. Where the Christmas truce began was in Flanders, the area of Belgium, France, just below the North Sea and the English Channel, where the land was actually below sea level, held in by dikes and bulwarks and seawalls. They were living in miserable conditions because everything was muddy. The troops on both sides had dug in trenches. There was a stalemate that had taken place just after the bad weather began in late November. They were living in terrible shape. The trenches were flooded, cold rain and mud. had made things worse. Unless soldiers in mucky hideaways stayed awake, they could drown, quite literally sinking into the liquefying mud. Many slept erect where they could. It was very difficult to accomplish one's bodily functions or sleep or eat under those conditions. And so there was not much fighting. It was a matter of live and let live until the weather got better. And it was under those conditions that the Christmas truce began. A German soldier who later became a famous artist named Otto Dix was on the front lines, and he described the landscape as lice, rats, barbed wire, fleas, bombs, underground caves, corpses, blood, liquor, mice, cats, artillery, filth, bullets, mortars, fire, steel. That's what war is, he said. It's the work of the devil. So under those conditions, it was a live and let live situation until something happened that made a Christmas truce Christmassy. And that began on both sides independently. The British, during the Boer War, that is the war in South Africa in 1899-1900, had sent brass Christmas boxes to the troops thousands of miles away, figuring that they'd be lonely and unhappy that far away. And Queen Victoria, in her last years, arranged for this. These were small brass boxes filled basically with chocolates, and the troops loved getting them. Some of them claimed that having them in their pockets actually stopped bullets. But in any cases, in 1914, military people remembered doing this and decided, let's do it again. And so they prepared brass Christmas boxes to send across the North Sea to Belgium and Flanders for their troops, basically, again, containing chocolates, in some cases other kinds of goodies. The Germans got wind of this, and they prepared wooden boxes, pretty much the same size, pretty much like 3x5, and they put in them sausages and typically German goodies, and cigars and cigarettes, and these were sent to the troops. But the Germans had something else they could do that the British couldn't. The Germans originated the idea of the Christmas tree, and their idea was the tabletop Christmas tree, not the big monsters that we have over here. The Christmas trees could be brought into the front lines quite literally by the Germans because they, after all, had a ground connection to Germany, which the British didn't. The British had to cross the water for it. And so the Germans brought in Christmas trees and had them already fixed with candles attached. Lighting candles would have been a serious mistake in the front lines, but the Germans decided they'd do so anyway. After all, there was this live and let peace, and they'd take a chance that the bullets might fly. And on the bulwarks of their trenches, many German soldiers propped up the Christmas trees and lit the candles and waited to see what would happen. In some cases, there were some shots fired at them. In most cases, the British were intensely curious as to what was going on across the front lines only 60 or 70 yards away. You have to remember that the distances between the enemies was actually shorter than the length of a football field, but they were separated by trenches and by very bad weather and by bulwarks above the trenches. The British actually crawled out into no man's land, the area between the trenches, to see what was going on. And the Germans, seeing that, crawled out too. And pretty soon there was some camaraderie in the middle of the night on Christmas Eve. There began the actual Christmas truce.
I wanted to back up because, as I understood from your book, this actually did begin perhaps mid-December, a few weeks out.
There were a few cases about the 19th of December, in other words, about a week before Christmas, when this live and let live policy in that bad weather resulted in temporary cessations of shooting so both sides could retrieve their wounded and their dead and bury the dead. And they got to know each other that way, and they discovered that they were people like themselves. You can demonize the enemy from far away, but you can't demonize your enemy when the enemy is close up, especially when they look like you. And this is one of the reasons why we haven't had Christmas truces before or since. In most cases, the Christmas truce, which was unique in 1914, couldn't happen because of the cultural differences, the cultural distances, in fact. This couldn't have happened in World War II, fighting the Japanese. It couldn't have happened with the Nazis who didn't believe in Christmas in World War II. So this was a very unusual situation. when both sides loved Christmas trees and Christmas gifts and sang Christmas carols and looked like each other.
I thought there were many interesting occurrences in your book that describe what was going on. There was one particular time about a week before Christmas when the Germans ostensibly slipped a chocolate cake into the British lines with an invitation to a concert.
They said it was their captain's birthday, and they were going to have a concert for him, and the British could listen. They weren't Christmas carols, but this was something that had happened in an earlier war, the idea of a concert given by another side. During the Civil War, there were occasions when North and South had trumpet competitions across the lines. They had cornets and trumpets and bands. Now, they didn't really meet, but there was this musical competition. In World War I, at least in the first year of the war, the two sides on Christmas Eve sang to each other. The Germans began it singing Silent Night, and although they sang it in German, the tune was familiar to the British. They sang it too in their own language. Songs went back and forth between the sides during the darkness of Christmas Eve, and pretty soon there was competition again. The Germans had a singer from the Berlin Opera named Walter Kirchhoff, who was called on to sing, and he sang Christmas carols very lustily across the trenches. It sounds unbelievable, but when you realize there was less than the length of a football field between them, and they were bogged down in rain and mud and unlikely to try to advance or fire, it's easy to see how this could happen. The French hated the Germans because in 1870, the Germans had warred on the French and taken the provinces of Alsace and Lorraine away from the French. Theoretically, they weren't going to have any Christmas truce, and censorship claimed that they didn't, but the French sent out a singer from the Paris Opera who sang to the Germans O Holy Night. And so there was a very strange, almost dreamlike atmosphere that was beginning to permeate both lines.
So there actually says something about two things here. One is, as you mentioned, the demonization of somebody who's right in front of you, which is a little bit harder to do. It also speaks about this kind of shared cultural connection, but it's also the power of music.
The power of music certainly had a lot to do with it. The British were far more interested in singing bawdy songs to the Germans, which they did, and I quote several of them in my book. The Germans were amused by it and knew English. This was, again, one of the unusual factors. Many of the Germans had actually worked in England before the war. They had had jobs as barbers and taxi drivers and waiters and other kinds of jobs that didn't require a good deal of schooling, but they learned English. And their officers and some other senior people in their lines learned English in school. The British didn't learn German, but the Germans learned English, and they could speak to the British, and they could exchange jabs at them and sing at them. So there was a cultural mix that couldn't have occurred in many other wars. One thing they wanted to do, as they had done before, was bury the dead. They could get together more closely if they could cross their lines, which were pockmarked by shell holes filled with water and also blocked by corpses that had been there for quite a long time. They wanted to bury them. And somebody got the idea, which spread across the lines, we could play football in daylight if we had a clear area. And so they agreed that after dawn, they would get together between the lines, they'd fill in the shell holes, and they'd bury the dead. And they did in many areas in the 300-mile length of the front lines from the North Sea to the Swiss border. And that meant the Belgians and the British and the French and the Germans on the other side, who included Austrians and Bavarians, who were far more peaceful-minded than the Prussians on the German side. They did bury the dead in joint ceremonies. Their chaplains came out and officiated, and they did actually play soccer, football in their language. At first, I didn't believe this happened. I had read little bits about the Christmas truce, and many historians said, well, this, of course, was legendary, and the whole idea that they could have played football is quite mythic. But I looked it up in the Imperial War Museum in London and in archives in Germany and in letters sent by the troops. And certainly they played football. They described it very accurately. They used improvised balls and goals. And their official documents, the company diaries, even had the scores.
And so who won?
The Germans won most of the games. And they were very proud of that. But the important thing was that they were able to get together on Christmas Day and pretend that there was no war going on between them.
Here we have these soldiers on the front lines laying their weapons down and fraternizing with the other side, despite the fact that it's a court-martial offense.
But you see, they had gifts they could give out. They had their Christmas boxes, and they had other presents sent from home. The British were loaded up with presents because the newspapers had publicized the fact that the troops need gifts. And they were loaded up with mince pies and other such things. The Germans had never seen a mince pie, and the British were glad to get rid of a lot of them. There was a lot of trading back and forth. And in one case, I found a German had traded his helmet, the Tickelhaube with the horn-like device at the top of the helmet, to a British soldier. And a day later, he came back to the soldier and said, "We're going to have an inspection. I need to borrow it back." The British had no helmets yet. It would be 2 years into the war before they had steel helmets. They traded food. They traded various kinds of equipment. And they mixed together. And they did so until the German higher-ranking officers and the Allied higher-ranking officers began to be concerned. After all, there's no war if the soldiers don't fight. You've got to get them back to fighting again. And they actually managed to do so. It wasn't easy, because once you meet your friends who are the enemy and you see them face to face, it's hard to fight them again. One soldier actually met his former barber, who's German, and he said, "You need a back and sides. Sit down and I'll take care of that." And he trimmed his hair on the front lines. What do you do under such circumstances? They sang together. They ate together. The only thing they could do from the higher up angle was to move them out. In other words, to replace them with reserves who had been indoctrinated to hate. And so they pulled out many of the troops on the front lines and after Christmas replaced them with other troops and forced them to fire again.
Just a quick reminder that you are listening to The Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're speaking with Stanley Weintraub about the historic impromptu ceasefire of World War I, known as the Christmas Truce. You described this as everywhere you looked, people were talking and playing. How many of the front lines really were engaged?
It depended on the commanding officers involved. There were areas where there was no fighting, and there were areas where the senior officers said, "I order you under pain of court-martial to keep fighting." And so some of them had to shoot. When they did, they generally shot high up in the air over the heads of the troops opposite them. They refused to have actual fighting go on. I found a number of instances of this where the junior officers on both sides would go out into no man's land and meet, and they would say, "We're being forced to fire again. We'll fire high up in the air. We'll send a flare up to let you know, and then you can go into hiding or into your trenches." They did this in very surprising ways. Often they exchanged gifts. A German would exchange his gloves for a British scarf, for example, and then they'd go back and they'd fire a flare. A few hours later, the fighting would resume.
In
some cases, it lasted into New Year's, not because they were celebrating New Year's Day, but because the weather was still so bad.
One of the instances that you described in your book was when a French person warned the Germans to, quote, "be on guard tomorrow. A general is coming to visit our position. For reasons of shame and honor, we will have to fire."
And, of course, they did. But there were some very strange things that occurred that are almost unbelievable. Soldiers would write home about them and talk about them as if they were a waking dream. And I researched this over the years by going to the British newspaper library in North London in Colindale and reading the letters to the editor in provincial newspapers where soldiers had written to their wives and girlfriends and parents and said, "You won't believe what has just happened," and went on to describe the meetings between the two sides and the fraternization. The newspapers were sent these by the people who received those letters, and they printed them. So I found literally hundreds of such letters, both in Germany and in England, that were printed before censorship began.
You mentioned the media's response, and it sounded from what you found in your research that there was considerable resistance in mass media, other than these letters, to treat this as important as you see it as, like they really downplayed it. What is your assessment of this?
The managements of the newspapers were trying to be ultra-patriotic, and they didn't like this idea, but the pressure for such news was terrific. As the soldiers said, it seemed like a waking dream. But a dream doesn't last. You wake up, and you wake up to reality. The war began again, and there would never be another Christmas truce in military history.
And do you think we never have another Christmas truce in military history, partly because the leaders who, you made very clear, this is war is being driven by the leaders, not by the soldiers, learned from this?
Well, the military leaders are a professional group. Their job is to win wars, to fight and defend one's country. And soldiers, for the most part, in a big war, are drafted. They come from the farms and the factories and other such places, and they're not professional. They have no careers dependent on winning a war, and they have to be propagandized into wanting to win a war. It's very difficult, for example, right now, to try to convince a soldier, even though he's an enlisted person in Afghanistan, that there's something very important for his own country involved in fighting and possibly dying in Afghanistan.
When you look at this in a historical context and you do put it in today's time frame, which, for example, in the Afghanistan case that you mentioned, what do you take away as the wisdom of the Christmas truce?
The wisdom of the Christmas truce is that we're all the same, and there are many reasons why we should be friends instead of enemies. And that's hard to accept if there are no cultural connections. It's hard to accept if you have the other side unwilling to admit that there is anything that you represent that is going to create friendship.
The other takeaway that I thought about is the role of leaders and the role of mass media in some cases in being able to convince people of the either reasons for the war and the demonization of the other and all of the beliefs that can arise from that. And one thing that I underlined in your book pertained to a particular leader, which was Hitler, who would not participate in the Christmas truce.
He didn't believe in Christmas, so he wouldn't participate. He hated the enemy, and the enemy didn't believe anything that he did. But you mentioned the mass media. That's a big difference now, too. The mass media during World War I, 1914, were largely the newspapers, and the newspaper owners represented, in effect, big business and therefore big government. That has become dissipated. Radio came in, television came in. I was in Korea in 1951-52 when live television existed in America, but it brought home the reality of war, what it was really like visually. That hadn't happened before. Now we have other mass media, all the electronic media, and it's very difficult to try to manipulate all of the sources of information. And so it's difficult now to develop one kind of bandwagon that everybody follows.
Your ultimate conclusion at the end I thought was quite beautiful. You said you conclude that the Christmas truce is a celebration of the human spirit and a moving manifestation of the absurdities of war.
But it's only true when you have cultural relationships with your enemy.
It would be interesting to see what cross-cultural relationships could generate as well, because there are things that all humanity shares. It may not be Christmas. It may be something else.
In the past, we could go back to ancient Greece and, let's say, the war is described in the Iliad, and find there were temporary truces to bury the dead or for some religious reason. They didn't last, and the war began again. There were truces in other wars, basically, again, for burying the dead and retrieving the wounded. But the cultural differences have become far greater.
The other thing that you had said was that the war continued not because the soldiers wanted to fight. In fact, the soldiers were in some ways trying to prevent their so-called enemy from being harmed. And so it was really the generals and the political leaders that then had to change the soldiers on the front line in order to continue a war.
Yeah. If you have a military defeat, your government's going to go down. if you have a military defeat, your general is going to lose his job. So a lot of this has to do with the intentions and the needs of the people who make the decisions.
And let's conclude with the counterfactuals that you started, which is, what if?
What if people refuse to fight? We've had mass demonstrations in cities and the Arab countries in North Africa, which suggest what can happen when people get out in the mass and dare their governments to do what they don't want them to do. It's possible. It's possible, but it's not easy, and it can be very costly and dangerous and harmful to the people involved.
Well, Stanley Weintraub, thank you so much. The book, again, is called Silent Night, The Story of the World War I Christmas Truce. And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at @Armudian, and we'll see you next week.
You know, one of the terrible things, I think, about the kind of consumptive life or consumptive society that we live in is that one of the first things it consumes is our history. And so over and over again, those things that would allow us to make coalitions, to make connections between the things that have happened to us, the things that have happened to our mothers, to our fathers, to people before us, are lost. And as I say elsewhere, we're constantly being put in the position of having to reinvent the wheel.
I get upset when, even with my own children, I have to remind you, you know, you come from somewhere. You belong to a couple thousand year old family. And it's exciting to look back because it gives you ideas for the future.
The Pacifica Radio Archives, the people's history since 1949.
We must admit the past. Only the person who knows her past, his past, can begin to essay where she or he is today and how she or he may begin to chart his tomorrow. Her tomorrow.
Go to PacificaRadioArchives.org, the people's history since 1949.
I'm diving deeper, deeper for you.